This is VOA News. I'm Joe Ramsey. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said on Monday Ukraine's top military commanders pledged to keep defending Bakhmut when asked how to deal further with the situation of the besieged city.
Фактично саме тема Бахмута стала основною.
Zelensky said at a meeting of top military officials he had asked the commander of the regional grouping and Ukraine's commander-in-chief how they proposed to proceed. Both generals responded, he said, not to withdraw but to strengthen our defenses. That's what Zelensky said in his nightly address. Local officials say civilians are fleeing the bombardment. VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine podcast spoke with Anna Chernikova in Kyiv for more.
A lot of Ukrainian forces are actually still located in the city. There are some actions happening, so movements around, but there are no confirmations of any movements away from the city, so it could be just tactical movements around the city of Bakhmut. So for the moment, what we are hearing that Ukrainian forces remain at the defense in the city of Bakhmut, and there are no plans of withdrawing, at least for this point of time.
Find VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine podcast online at voanews.com. Ukraine's top prosecutor said on Monday a criminal investigation had been launched into what he called the, quote, brutal and brazen shooting of an unarmed person depicted in a video shared on social media and accused Russia of ignoring the laws of war. A 12-second video widely shared on Twitter shows an apparently unarmed man in uniform with a Ukrainian flag insignia on his arm standing smoking in a wooded area. The man says, "Glory to Ukraine." Multiple shots are heard. A voice is heard in Russian. This is VOA News. Protesters demonstrated Monday in Nigeria's capital, Abuja, angry at the country's Electoral Commission's handling of last month's disputed election. Reuters correspondent David Doyle has more.
Nigerian presidential candidate Atiku Abubakar led hundreds of protesters on a peaceful march to the country's Electoral Commission headquarters on Monday. Ruling party candidate Bola Tinubu was named the winner. Atiku and his People's Democratic Party, or PDP, have rejected the outcome as fraudulent. Observers from the European Union and other organizations have criticized poor planning and voting delays, but did not allege fraud. INEC has itself apologized for technical problems. Both Atiku and third-placed Labour Party candidate Peter Obi have vowed to challenge the result in court.
Reuters correspondent David Doyle. The U.S. government is working with authorities in Mexico to try to locate four Americans who were kidnapped at gunpoint as they crossed the border from Texas. AP correspondent Jackie Quinn reports.
The FBI is offering a $50,000 reward for the return of four missing Americans who crossed into Mexico to buy medicine last week. Agents say their white minivan came under fire and a shootout left at least one Mexican citizen dead. All four Americans were placed into a vehicle and driven away.
We're standing ready to provide all appropriate consular assistance.
State Department spokesman Ned Price says this is considered a dangerous area. A witness in Mexico says she saw the gunman force a woman to walk to their pickup. Two other people were dragged, and one was carried to the vehicle, which then drove off. I'm Jackie Quinn.
Gary Rossington, the last surviving original member of the American rock band Lynyrd Skynyrd, has died at the age of 71, according to the band. No cause of death was given. AP correspondent Margie Zarletta has more.
Rossington's slide guitar on Freebird helped make it the best-known Lynyrd Skynyrd song ever. The song That Smell was inspired by his 1976 car accident. Rossington also co-wrote Sweet Home Alabama, Give Me Back My Bullets, and What's Your Name?
What's your name?
Rossington said in a 1993 AP interview he rarely listened to Skynyrd music because he'd recall the personal things.
It's happy memories and sad memories, but it's good. It's hard to listen to it alone. If I'm with somebody, we're together, we'll listen.
I'm Archie Zarletta.
Tropical Storm Freddy returned to Madagascar in what meteorologists described on Monday as a rare loop trajectory, killing four people, including two children, as it hit for the second time in as many weeks. I'm Joe Ramsey, VOA News.
Today is Tuesday, March 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinua Ofo in Washington. Coming up in the next half hour, the UN says the Taliban's treatment of Afghan women and girls could amount to a crime against humanity.
The Taliban's intentional and calculated policy is to repudiate the human rights of women and girls and to erase them from public life.
UNICEF says malnutrition among mothers and adolescent girls is increasing in a dozen countries.
So it's climate, the droughts are more frequent and more severe and longer. And the people in those regions, in the Horn of Africa, the arid regions, never really recover fully from the previous drought cycle.
And a Nigerian presidential candidate and supporters protest the handling of last month's disputed vote. We'll have these stories and more next on International Edition. Stay tuned. Ukrainian military leaders are vowing to hold on to Bakhmut as Russian forces encroach on a devastated eastern city. The Kremlin has long sought to capture it for months at the cost of thousands of lives. Less than a week ago, an advisor to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the Ukrainian defenders might retreat from Bakhmut and fall back to nearby positions. But Zelensky's office said Monday that he chaired a meeting in which the country's top military brass spoke in favor of continuing the defense and strengthening the Ukrainian positions. The Taliban's treatment of women and girls in Afghanistan could amount to a crime against humanity, according to a UN report presented on Monday at the Human Rights Council in Geneva. The Taliban seized power in August 2021, drastically curtailing women's freedom and rights, including their ability to attend high school and university. In a report covering July to December 2022, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan, Richard Burnett, found that the Taliban's treatment of women and girls may amount to gender persecution, a crime against humanity.
The Taliban's intentional and calculated policy is to repudiate the human rights of women and girls and to erase them from public life. It may amount to the international crime of gender persecution, for which the authorities can be held accountable. The cumulative effect of the restrictions on women and girls has a devastating long-term impact on the whole population, and it is tantamount to gender apartheid. It's the responsibility of this council to continue to grapple earnestly with the tremendous human rights challenges facing the people of Afghanistan, including those involving their economic, social, and cultural rights, and to ensure that a strong message is sent to the de facto authorities that the abysmal treatment of women and girls is intolerable and unjustifiable on any ground, including religion. Moreover, there must be consequences for those responsible for serious human rights violations. Long-standing impunity needs to be challenged, as well as present crimes. While welcome and necessary in the short term, international humanitarian assistance cannot and should not replace a functioning economy, and this dependency must be addressed. Instead of intensifying its efforts to remedy the situation, the Taliban continues to interfere in aid delivery. I urge them to immediately cease actions that disrupt equitable and speedy access to humanitarian aid to those most in need, particularly women and children.
That's UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Afghanistan, Richard Burnett. In a new report released Tuesday, day before International Women's Day, UNICEF says malnutrition among mothers and adolescent girls has soared by 25% over the last 3 years in a dozen countries, and most of them are in Africa. Christian Rudert is a nutrition advisor for the UNICEF Eastern and Southern African Regional Office. She tells VOA's Carol Van Dam she saw alarmingly thin women in Ethiopia, Somalia, South Sudan due to conflicts, drought, flooding, and climate change, among other factors.
It's climate, the droughts are more frequent and more severe and longer. And the people in those regions in the Horn of Africa, the arid regions, never really recover fully from the previous drought cycle. So they're already vulnerable. And then this latest crisis comes on top. South Sudan, sort of large combination of different factors. There's chronic flooding. Some parts of South Sudan, where I was actually last week, are permanently underwater. And people are wading through the water to go about their daily lives.
We've seen video of that. It's crazy that these people have no choice but to just up and move, because otherwise they would be living in submerged conditions all the time.
And so there's lots of displacement, and that always makes people very vulnerable. In South Sudan, there's also sporadic conflict and insecurity that also affects people. People don't grow food when they don't know if they're going to be attacked or, you know, have to move. I've seen in Ethiopia, northern Ethiopia, some of the women that I've seen, I've met, you know, on my travels. It's just so striking when people are visibly thin, so thin. And, you know, we've had staggering rates of acute malnutrition in the screening of pregnant and breastfeeding women that we do. Up to 70-80% are acutely malnourished, and their children, of course, as well. It's very striking and very concerning to see women, you know, malnourished at that level.
And these are women that come from these countries like South Sudan, where the soil is usually fertile and rich. And if they don't have droughts or flooding like there is in South Sudan and parts of South Sudan, or deadly conflict, they're okay. They can feed themselves, right?
They can. I mean, the drought and parts of the region are chronically affected by drought and crops, and also pasture for livestock, on which a lot of people depend, gets more and more fragile. Other parts of the whole Greater Horn of Africa are indeed quite fertile, but the parts of South Sudan where crops are grown, and, you know, the parts of Ethiopia where crops are grown, even Kenya, we have very high rate of malnutrition also in northern Kenya. Because Kenya is like two different countries, with the northern arid part of the country more and more like other parts of the Horn, like Somalia. So food doesn't move around very efficiently, and people are also chronically very impoverished. And that's one of the key factors that we highlight in the report, that, you know, women are also disproportionately affected by food insecurity. The most disadvantaged households and populations, the women in those populations are also much more likely to be acutely malnourished.
And these women are supposed to be taking care of their families. And if they're malnutritioned, how are they going to take care of their families?
And often they'll prioritize taking care of their families first. So they'll feed the children, and then there's very little left for themselves. They often are supposed to feed the men first. So when I was talking to families in South Sudan last week, everyone says, oh, the men eat the meat, they eat the more nutritious foods, the children eat the scraps of what of that what's left. And no one even mentioned the women eating. So women are eating last, they're eating less nutritious foods.
That's Christiane Rudette, a nutrition advisor for the UNICEF Eastern and Southern Regional Office. She was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from Nairobi, Kenya. Australian Air Force chiefs have revealed that pilots have been offered counseling after they encountered Chinese military jets over the South China Sea. Australia has been flying over the disputed area for decades, but senior officers say China's military aircraft are now behaving more dangerously. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Under Operation Gateway, Australia carries out maritime surveillance patrols in the North Indian Ocean and the South China Sea. Most patrols are routine, but some have caused alarm. In May 2022, a Royal Australian Air Force surveillance plane was intercepted by a Chinese military aircraft, which released aluminium chaff that was ingested into the engine of the Australian plane. At the time, officials in Canberra accused Beijing of intimidation, but Australian Air Force officials now believe the encounter might have been caused by a miscalculation by the Chinese J-16 fighter pilot. Other unspecified encounters with Chinese forces have been reported since then. Australian Air Vice Marshal Darren Goldie told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation Monday that it's important air crews are properly debriefed after stressful missions.
The mental health of our aviators and people that are coming in contact with things like intercepts or challenges on the radio, it's important that when we bring them back, we talk to them about the experience and we talk to them about what services are available should they be troubled by the experiences they saw.
The South China Sea lies to Australia's north. It has vital shipping lanes and has been a regional flashpoint for years. Several countries claim ownership of its small islands and access to natural resources. In recent years, Beijing has been increasingly assertive in the region. Australian Air Force patrols are part of Canberra's efforts to establish a viable rules-based strategic order in the Indo-Pacific region. Tensions in the region have been part of deteriorating diplomatic relations between Australia and China in recent years. There has been friction over democracy in Hong Kong, human rights in China's Xinjiang province, the future of Taiwan, and Beijing's ambitions in the South Pacific. However, a centre-left government that won an election in Australia in May 2022 has been eager to reduce tensions with the country's biggest trading partner. High-profile meetings between senior government officials in recent months have been interpreted as a sign that diplomatic frictions are being eased. But analysts believe the potential for aggressive military encounters in the South China Sea show that vigilance is needed. China accounts for about a third of Australia's global trade. Government data shows that the export of Australian goods and services to China were worth $123 billion in 2020-2021. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
In other news, Nigerian presidential candidate Atiku Abubakar on Monday led hundreds of supporters in a peaceful protest over the Electoral Commission's handling of last month's disputed vote, in which it says was won by ruling party candidate Bola Tinubu. Atiku and senior members of the opposition People's Democratic Party led placard-holding supporters during a march to the offices of the Independent National Electoral Commission, or INEC, in the federal capital Abuja, where they handed in a petition. Armed police with tear gas canisters stood nearby. Election observers from the European Union, the Commonwealth, and other bodies reported a range of problems, among them failures in a system designed to prevent vote manipulation. This is VOA's International Edition. I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington. United Nations experts report the human rights situation in Eritrea remains dire and shows no sign of improving as the government continues to violate the rights of its people with impunity. The country's human rights situation was reviewed at the UN Human Rights Council Monday, and Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN Deputy High Commissioner for Human Rights Nada Al-Nashif says her office continues to receive credible reports of torture, arbitrary detention, enforced disappearances, and other human rights violations in Eritrea. She told the Human Rights Council Monday that thousands of Eritrean political prisoners reportedly have been jailed for decades. She said hundreds of religious leaders and followers have been arbitrarily arrested and harassed because of their faith. She added, all these human rights violations are committed with complete impunity.
No person has been held accountable for the human rights violations documented by the Commission of Inquiry on Human Rights in Eritrea in 2016 and in 2017, which found that Eritrea had committed crimes against humanity, including enslavement, imprisonment, enforced disappearance, torture, and other inhumane acts, persecution, rape, and murder.
The report condemns the forcible conscription of Eritreans, which it notes intensified during the Tigray conflict in northern Ethiopia. It said conscripts remained subject to indefinite military service, often in abusive conditions, and conscription remains the main reason Eritreans flee the country. The UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, reports at the end of 2022, there were more than 160,000 Eritrean asylum seekers in Ethiopia and over 130,000 Eritrean refugees in Sudan. The Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in Eritrea, Mohamed Abdelsalam Babiker, said since November, he has received many reports of intensified government roundups of young people into the national service.
Witnesses have also reported to me the increased forced conscription by the military and security forces, who have been entering and searching houses for this purpose. Many families were evicted from their properties and forced to live outside their homes if they did not hand over or surrender their missing family members or relatives.
Adam Osman Idris is First Secretary of Eritrea's Permanent Mission to the United Nations in Geneva. He accused the United Nations and what he called hostile nations of relentless harassment of his country for more than 10 years. He said the appointment of a special rapporteur was unwarranted and linked to the hostile agenda of Eritrea's detractors. Idris said Eritrea continued to make substantial improvement in the fundamental rights and equality of its citizens. He said his government would persist in its development agenda despite what he called harassment from certain powers. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Thank you, Lisa. As the Egyptian economy struggles with multiple challenges, some tech sectors appear to be performing well. Consumers, though, are facing serious troubles as inflation erodes their purchasing power. Edward Uranian reports for VOA from Cairo.
At a clothing market not far from the River Nile, Egyptians rummage through hand-me-downs and haggle over prices. Ordinary Egyptians are buying lower-end merchandise as their purchasing power is eroded by inflation and the effects of Egypt's weakening currency on the prices of imported goods. President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi told a gathering of international leaders several months ago that the Russia-Ukraine conflict was seriously affecting Egypt's economy. Egypt buys most of its grain from Russia and Ukraine, and the price of importing wheat for a population of more than 100 million people has gone up drastically. David Butter, an economist at Britain's Chatham House Research Group, tells VOA that Egypt's rocky economy has been affected by a large increase in external and internal debt, made worse by a succession of crises, including COVID-19, the Russia-Ukraine conflict, and increases in U.S. interest rates that have aggravated capital outflows from the country.
It's a structural fiscal deficit, big buildup of external debt, which is allied to large public debt. So there's a whole lot of heavy burdens that the economy is carrying, and it has depended to get through this situation on having a sustained period of relatively high growth and improved balance of payments. So as soon as one or two wheels fall off this rather unstable wagon, then they're in big trouble.
Butter notes that Gulf states came to Egypt's rescue by adding $13 billion in deposits to Egypt's central bank after international investors pulled $14 billion out of the country last year. Gulf states and the international community have helped Egypt out of numerous economic crises in recent years, including a $3 billion IMF loan in December. Egyptian political sociologist Saeed Sadiq tells VOA that Egypt has agreed to privatize large portions of its economic sector in the next few years, and that Prime Minister Mustafa Madbouly just returned from a trip to Qatar, where he discussed investment opportunities in Egyptian companies.
Devaluation is expected this month, with the hope that this would push Gulf states to buy Egyptian companies that are listed, and that would generate a lot of foreign currency that the government needs to pay debt and interest on debt.
A shortage of dollars has caused Egypt's central bank to raise interest rates and triggered a decrease in the value of the Egyptian pound, making prices rise since the country imports 65% of what its citizens consume. Many merchants, like Abdu, a dry cleaner, say they are downbeat. The economy is terrible, he says, adding it's a struggle to make enough to live on. Lots of people come to rummage through the merchandise, he says, but they don't spend a lot of money because they don't have a lot of money to spend. Consumers have complained about how the crisis is affecting them. Jamila, a 45-year-old homemaker, buys chicken from a merchant who sells government-subsidized meat from a truck along a large boulevard in the Cairo suburb of Do'i. She says that despite the subsidized prices, the meat is still too expensive. While many people and businesses are struggling, others are flourishing. Jürgen Starkau, who is the general manager of the Cairo Marriott in the Zamalek area, says that his hotel is completely full and that business has never been better.
All the major hotels on the River Nile in Cairo are doing extremely well.
despite the previous setbacks of the Ukraine conflict as well as COVID.
Egypt also has prospects of increasing natural gas revenues from undersea fields. Saeed Sadek points out that Egypt is the only country in the eastern Mediterranean that is capable of liquefying natural gas and sending it to Europe by pipeline, giving it a huge economic advantage over regional rivals. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Season 3 of the Basketball Africa League is here. Starting off in Dakar from March 11th to March 21st for the Sahara Conference, then heading to Cairo from April 26th to May 6th for the Nile Conference, and the excitement continues to build in the finals in Kigali from May 21st to May 27th. Tune in and follow the BAL starting this Saturday on The Voice of America.
This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours at voanews.com and check out voafrica.com for more English language programming. You can find International Edition and our current affairs programs, Encounter, Press Conference USA, and Issues in the News on voanews.com. Until next time, I am Chinedu Ofor in Washington, wishing you a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
1 year ago, after months of saber-rattling and denial of the international community's warnings that a Russian incursion into Ukraine was imminent, Vladimir Putin launched a full-scale military invasion on its sovereign neighbor. The largest land war in Europe since World War II had begun, and the principles that had been the cornerstone of peace, prosperity, and stability on this planet for more than 75 years were at risk of being shattered, said President Biden during his recent visit of Poland.
When Russia invaded, it wasn't just Ukraine being tested. The whole world faced a test for the ages, and the questions we faced were as simple as they were profound. Would we respond? Or would we look the other way?
When President Putin ordered his tanks to roll into Ukraine, he thought we would roll over. He was wrong, said President Biden. The Ukrainian people are too brave. America, Europe, a coalition of nations from the Atlantic to the Pacific, we were too unified. Democracy was too strong.
Instead of an easy victory he perceived and predicted, Putin left with burnout tanks and Russia's forces in disarray. He thought he'd get the Finlandization of NATO. Instead, he got the NATOization of Finland and Sweden. He thought NATO would fracture and divide. Instead, NATO is more united and more unified than ever before.
A dictator bent on rebuilding an empire will never be able to erase the people's love of liberty, said President Biden. Brutality will never grind down the will of the free. And Ukraine will never be a victory for Russia. Never.
1 year after the bombs began to fall, Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine. Ukraine is still independent and free. From Kherson to Kharkiv, Ukrainian fighters have reclaimed their land. More than 50% of the territory Russia held last year, the blue and the yellow flag of Ukraine proudly waves once again. President Zelensky still leads a democratically elected government that represents the will of the Ukrainian people.
As Ukraine continues to defend itself against the Russian onslaught and launch counteroffensives of its own, there will continue to be hard and very bitter days, victories, and tragedies, said President Biden. But Ukraine is steeled for the fight ahead. And the United States, together with our allies and partners, are going to continue to have Ukraine's back as it defends itself.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.